This is James Bowery, guest hosting a show on Red Ice Radio. On Memorial Day 2017, Kevin MacDonald and I had a conversation about war. Memorial Day is an appropriate day to remember the fallen of war. The fallen of the culture wars sacrificed livelihood, if not life itself. They fought, as individuals of integrity, against a protean yet pervasive invasion. Individuals respond as best they can until reinforcements arrive. Yet as individuals, they are as doomed as was Christ standing before the Sanhedrin. It is clear that the adversary has integrity as a group, if not as individuals. It is equally clear that the victims of this invasion have integrity as individuals, if not as a group. The culture of individual integrity tends, for obvious reasons, to view the culture of group integrity as a conspiracy. It is for this reason that I introduced the conversation with Kevin MacDonald with this brief reading about the concept of conspiracy. The definition of the word conspiracy as a conspiracy. The original definition of conspiracy, circa 1300s, was simply acting as one, derived from the Latin root breathe together, or to be acting in the same spirit, depending on the sense of spire, which was also the origin of spire in the sense of a cathedral's architectural spire. Therefore, the original definition does not denote conscious intent to act in coordination with others of the same spirit, as does the modern definition. Somewhere along the line, the connotation of deliberately coordinated action became denotative. I am going to argue below that this more restrictive denotation of conspiracy was the result of a conspiracy in the original sense of the word, a conspiracy which did not require any deliberate, consciously intended coordination of action, but was nevertheless the work of a group or groups for whom that restriction of definition was an evolutionary advantage to their selfish genes. Group selection produces unconscious, coordinated action between members of the group, and humans have been under group selection since our common ancestor to chimpanzees. See E.O. Wilson's The Social Conquest of Earth. This has the same quality of coordinated action that occurs in the eusocial organisms, organisms that also engage in group as opposed to individual combat, also known as war. Indeed, the world's foremost authority on eusocial organisms, E.O. Wilson, argues persuasively that human society, particularly civilization, is evolving in that direction, which ends in the reification of the group itself as meta-organism, a group of organisms, acting as one, on behalf of selfish genes expressing in the group's behavioral patterns. Now, here's the key. Because of the great diaspora of the human genotype into a wide variety of environments, there has arisen biodiversity in the human genome adapting to a wide variety of population densities. In the areas with higher population density, there has been stronger group selection than in areas with lower population density. Over the tens of millennia, and in particular over the last 10 millennia with the rise of agriculture, this has led to a substantial increase in the gradient of genetically adapted group cohesion. Because gene flow between groups was restricted by barriers of geography, language, and natural adaptation to climate, as well as, quote, xenophobia, end quote, this didn't immediately result in the destruction of the more individualistic populations. However, with the rise of empires and resulting mixing of widely dispersed populations, it became a decisive factor in human evolution. The original definition of conspire allowed more individualistic populations to talk about perceived patterns of behavior that were of vital interest to them, without taking on the burden of proof that there was some sort of conscious, secret cabal behind the pattern. This burden of proof was advantageous to the unconsciously coordinated group organisms, since it was, of course, impossible for the individualistic populations to bear in their attempts to come to grips with what was happening to them. The most recent and stark example of this is in the mass rapes occurring in Cologne, Germany, where there is a conspiracy theory that the refugees acted in a conspiratorial manner to have some of them creating diversions while others engaged in rape of German women. There is no need to posit conscious intent on the part of the, quote, rape-fugees, and there is reason to believe they may be from populations more adept at group conflict, unconscious warfare, than others. Individualistic cultures have been deprived of a word vital to their ability to talk about their interests, and they can't even talk about how they came to be so deprived. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I guess I'd like to start this by getting your reaction to my little essay about the word conspiracy. Did you read that?
Yeah. I didn't realize this. Back in the 13th century or 14th century, it was a different meaning. But certainly it does imply now, it usually implies conscious intent.
Problem is, of course, that individualistic cultures like ours, if we can't talk about unconscious conspiracies as arising from evolutionary dynamics, and then we're continually placed in a position where we have to defend the proposition that there is some kind of conscious organization going on, puts us at a disadvantage in being able to compete in public discourse. And makes it so that we can't even talk to each other about exactly what's going on. We individuals out here who are trying to communicate with each other about the attack that we're being subjected to and organize ourselves some kind of a counter response, it really handicapped our ability to even talk about the situation. If we could prove that there was a conscious conspiracy, then we could basically say, yeah, we're in a state of war, so let's organize for war and get rid of this conspiracy. But because the word has these connotations.
You talk about the war on the West, endless immigration and all that, or what?
Right. I'm using war as sort of the continuation of politics by other means, or if you want to switch it around, politics is the continuation of war by other means. Clearly, the political situation, and not just the political situation, but the global economic situation and a variety of other things, are set up in such a way that it's having a devastating biological effect on us.
Yeah.
Is not necessarily benefiting the people who are perpetrating this necessarily, but it is clear that what's going on is there's some kind of cohesion and coordination behind it.
Well, yeah, I write about Jewish involvement in all this, and in that case, it's quite conscious. I mean, I cite over and over again people who are very consciously trying to make whites a minority, trying to flood these Western countries or any white country with non-whites, but it's very conscious in that case. I think, on the other hand, there's a lot of non-Jews white people who participate in this. They're liberals and neoconservatives and so on, and they don't want to be called a racist. And they're colluding with it, but they don't consciously want whites to become extinct or something. There's that. They don't have genocidal intentions or dupes because they are doing things that are not, as you say, they're against their long-term interests, obviously. And they are persuaded, they keep being persuaded by these arguments that it's not against their long-term interests, that everything's going to work out, that we're all going to be happy and we're going to end racism and everybody's going to live together because everybody's the same and that kind of thing. I mean, it's this utopian vision that they have.
Right. But trying to pick that apart or analyze what's going on psychologically, which is hopefully something that it's in your ballpark. You've written in the introduction to the Culture of Critique about altruistic punishment, for example, as a characteristic of individualistic cultures because of the fact that they need to have control mechanisms that other groups might not need to have to contain defection. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, what they see themselves as doing is engaging in altruistic punishment against something, right?
Yeah.
And the question is, well, what is it they see themselves as punishing? When the altruistic punishers, the people who are acting on behalf of the enemy, so to speak, are engaging in altruistic punishment of their own kin group, they are perceiving the members of their own kin group as, in some sense, defecting.
Yeah, is doing things that, it's defecting in sort of group selection terms. But yeah, I mean, and usually it's because they're violating some moral norm or principle that the punisher adheres to.
Well, let me propose this. Let's say that one of the things that individualistic cultures tend to have as moral standards is the avoidance of gang formation or conspiracy. If individualistic cultures tend to view as immoral gang behavior,
yeah,
or conspiratorial behavior,
yeah,
if you can point to some subset of that group as engaging in gang behavior or conspiratorial behavior, you can get a altruistic punishment of those members of the group. I.e., if you say, okay, you're racist, these people are racist, what you're really saying is these people are defecting from the individual culture because they're identifying with a group rather than as individuals. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's interesting.
And this might be an actual character of individualistic cultures. So what they're doing is if they don't perceive a conspiracy or they don't perceive a gang, and that gang is stigmatizing members of the target group as being gangs and conspiracies, then you can get this autoimmune response that takes advantage of the altruistic punishment that's supposed to maintain individualism, but in fact it's destroying the individualistic people on behalf of the group culture. In any event, that was sort of one of the things that I wanted to try to explore.
In fact, that may be true. I think at the psychological level, most of these people are acting because of some moral ideal, some moral norm that they have, that they've been taught. You know, that racism is evil. They don't think of racism as a group, you know, identity as much. I mean, they would abhor that. But in the end, they would abhor it in moral terms. And I think that's at the sort of proximate psychological level, that is what is moving this. That's why I've written so much about this moral imperative that these Western cultures, I think it is a characteristic of individualistic cultures, but the idea that, you know, that moral and your reputation as a moral person is critical to being part of the group. It's not that you help your relatives or you're part of this, you know, it's more an abstract moral goodness that people strive for. And I think that's what's driving a lot of this. That's just what I've sort of fathomed.
So the moral indoctrination you see as being sort of central to this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm proposing is that there may be some heritable sense of fairness about certain kinds of conflicts. I mean, for example, if you have two guys beat up one guy, right?
Yeah.
That's a different kind of primal instinct than having one guy and one guy, you know, coming into conflict.
Mano a mano.
Because if you look at sexual selection going back 600 million years, that's sort of been what's been happening in the vast majority of sexual species, right? What I'm saying is that there may be more to it than just indoctrination. That the indoctrination may be...
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that may be true. I think that part of individualistic culture, as we've evolved it, and I think that there is an evolutionary story about our individualistic culture, that the sense of fairness as a sort of abstract principle. And again, I think the individualist cultures are more than any other culture. I mean, there's no... I don't think it's any accident that things like Kant's moral imperative, categorical imperative, you know, came about in the Western society. You know, in other words, you have to act in a way that everybody else would act ideally in that situation. You know, it's an abstract moral principle. And I think that is what drives, you know, it's the same with, as I say, the emphasis is on a moral thing. And I think there may be something to that white people especially have a sense of fairness that's sort of ingrained and fair play that you see over and over again that you don't see in other cultures. You just don't see it. You go to African culture or Middle Eastern culture, and it's like it's really the strongest prevail. They don't really have an abstract sense of ethics. Certainly Jewish culture does not. I mean, it's really all about the group interests of Jews. They're just something about the West. And if you look at say, one of the things I've been researching is the campaigns against slavery. You know, they were all moralistic campaigns based on empathy, but also a sense of fairness and all of that. And again, that's unique. You just don't see that. I mean, you still see slavery in the world, and no other culture prohibited slavery on moral grounds like the West did. I do think that some of this is genetically influenced. I think there is an evolutionary story to Western individualism that is also cultural, but because there are a lot of cultural forces pushing in that direction for the last 2,000 years. But part of it is, I think, it's innate. I think that even people who are different from us, you know, like Africans or Chinese or something like that, we have a sense of fairness about treating them that I don't think you find in other human cultures. You know, and that's not all white people, and certainly there are other strands in white culture. I mean, there was a slavery that we had and among certain segments of the population.
Right.
That wasn't characteristic of the whole culture, and ultimately the anti-slavery forces won. And it's really, that is what is sort of, to me, is one of the big questions, is what caused that? And how do you understand Western culture as this complicated mix of subcultures and moral tendencies and then genetic tendencies pulling in different directions and so on? So it's just really extremely complex topic, I think.
It's not just complex, but it's also central to the existing struggle because of the fact that, I mean, right now, what I see happening in all of the white identity rhetoric is denunciation of individualism.
Yeah, it's true.
And what that may be doing is attacking an essential attribute of whites.
Yeah, I agree, and it's hard for us to submerge ourselves in a group context. And I think, you know, I mean, just looking at white identity movements, I think that it's hard for the individual leaders among the white identity people to really, you know, submerge their individualism and be part of a group and try to advance the interests of a group. I'm among the people who would say we have to get over individualism in a way, at least temporarily. We have to have a period where our group interests trump other things, because individualism, you know, is going to lead corporations to want cheap labor, no matter what the cost in terms of ethnic cohesion or anything else. Individualism results in people making all kinds of decisions in terms of leisure and where they put their money and all that, that are not, they're not useful to the group.
Well, yeah, an individual facing an implacable group enemy has a choice to make. And, I mean, you know, a very simple, stark choice is, for example, this immigration stuff and the terrorism. Well, I'm sitting here and I'm not going to be subjected to any kind of terrorist attacks very likely. But I know if I start talking out against it, that I could lose my job.
Right.
Right? And so it's a very clear choice that an individual has. An individual basically doesn't have much of a choice.
Yeah, most individuals are concerned. That's the power of the system that we live in now. I mean, it's so incentivized towards really the suicide of the West that people have to, you know, there are not too many people. I mean, I always felt I was in a privileged position because I had a university position that they couldn't fire me from. So I really had a real obligation to speak out.
Right.
Because if I didn't speak out, who the hell is going to? Because most people are going to lose their jobs, their livelihood, and everything else. I mean, I've lost a lot because of it, because of family and friends. But, you know, I really felt an obligation to do that.
Yeah, I did too professionally. I was in a position where I was, you know, relatively high echelon with connections, you know, one social degree of separation for like Bill Gates and stuff. And I felt like I had an obligation too back in the early 90s, and that caused me since I probably needed to have more, something more like what you had in terms of, you know, academic protection. But yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I understand that sense of obligation, and you know, I for that reason, I don't hate the whites who are vilifying me and want to see me commit suicide and stuff like that, because you know, these people are in extremely vulnerable situations.
Exactly. You can't hate them. You have to sort of try to understand them and try to see them as misguided and as having this conventional moral intuitions that are just poisonous in the world.
Well, they have to take them on because they're lively. You know, they could become homeless. You know,
they
could become homeless. It's a very vital. It's like, you know, it's not just a matter of being socially rejected. It's a matter of like, you know, do I have kids?
Right.
You know, or do my kids end up being turned out as you know, punks in a prison or as prostitutes in a corporate hierarchy or something? Right. So yeah, I mean, they really don't. Many people just are in a very, very bad position to even think about anything like this. And it's a terrible tragedy. But what one of the things that it illustrates, I think, is that Western cultures have traditionally, or I should historically, been absolutely supreme in military conflict.
Yeah.
And yet, absolutely incapable of fighting this war.
Absolutely incapable. That's okay. True.
And so the question is, what is the difference between social organization for war that we have, as we have understood it in the past, and social organization for war in this present conflict?
Yeah, I mean, the in terms of military organization, you know, nothing much has changed. I mean, you have you go in the military and you become part of a very cohesive group, and anybody who does not on page with that, they're going to suffer. They're going to get thrown out or thrown in the brig or whatever, and but yeah, with the rest of the society, it's been completely broken down, and of course I ascribe that this has been a top-down revolution. That this is the result of elite control, and the media, especially in the academic world, and that's why I emphasize Jewish involvement so much, because you know they are an elite, and all the non-Jews really who are part of that elite have to go along with that, and have all kinds of incentives to go along with it. So that's you know, and it's that unfortunately the white people who are doing this are selling out their own people. They're not seeing it in group terms, and that's what they, you know, that they're strongly encouraged to do that by all the ideological structures that are out there.
Well, let me propose this, that what individualistic cultures need in order to be able to defend themselves is not simply an awareness that there is a conflict or anything like that. What they need is an actual declaration of war that is widely accepted to designate an objective which, if obtained, will then reinstate a state of peace. In other words, if, for example, if you're not allowed to perceive that there is, in fact, a group that is attacking, then you don't have any objective that you can specify in a declaration of war.
I'd agree. I mean, I think we have to have a declaration of war. And I've often written that we have to be explicit about white identity. We have to be explicit about who are the people that are opposing us. And we can't shy away from talking about things like Jewish influence or these traitorous white people who are, you know, part of this very corrupt system and are benefiting from it individually at the expense of their own people.
Right, but I guess what I'm trying to get about the declaration of war that's critical is not so much that, you know, there is an us. It's more that there is a them.
Absolutely. We have
okay.
to talk about them. We have to be very angry, and we have to see it as a war. And in war, anything is permissible, basically. We have to take a no hold, no prisoners, you know, take no prisoners.
Right. It is something that goes beyond morality because of the fact that the enemy is not engaged in anything that can be conceived of as moral.
No, they're not. And they don't have, you know, any commitment to abstract moral ideals, despite all their rhetoric to the contrary. They right. don't have any commitment to that. And then these same people would be happy to produce a sort of 1984 George Orwellian state, you know, where you have complete control over individuals and monitor them all the time and punish severely anyone who goes out of order. And you know, that seemed to be where it was headed. That's why I thought that Hillary Clinton was going to be the, you know, really inaugurate that.
Yeah, that was very scary. I mean, it still is, of course. But you know, the point is that we have a little bit of breathing room. But
unfortunately, Trump isn't really doing it right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, the big thing that was a crisis situation. You get one more judge on the Supreme Court, and you've got hate speech laws.
Absolutely. I've said that many times. One more judge is what it took. Yeah. And she would have appointed some liberal judge, and in heartbeat, you'd have had hate speech laws that would have been okayed by the Supreme Court.
Right.
And you at the end of me being able to publish on the internet and all that. That's exactly where they were headed.
Right. People don't understand how close to the edge that things were. And, well, I shouldn't say people, but, you know, clearly a lot of people that supported Trump had a visceral sense, right, that there was.
Yeah.
And also, I suppose, on the other side, you know, they didn't really think about it in terms of, well, we're going to be able to finally have our, you know, 1984 situation. But they had the sense of power as being part of this you know, inner party, but, you know, they obviously weren't.
Yeah.
Okay, but the defining characteristic of a declaration of war, in my opinion, is that it designates a goal or an objective, I'll put it that way, because its accomplishment can be objectively determined by anyone engaged in waging the war, such that once the objective is obtained, it terminates the state of war and reinstates the state of peace. In other words, if you have something like, you know, well, we're whites, right, as your identity, that doesn't tell you when you've attained a state of peace, right? Yeah. And if you simply say, well, you know, as long as there are non-whites, then, you know, we're in a state of war, that's not exactly where you want to be either, because clearly that, I'll put it like this, most whites won't perceive that as moral, okay? And if you don't have a moral perception, I think in whites in particular, whites are going to be demoralized.
Absolutely, I agree. White people need a sense of what they're doing is morally okay, and so we have to formulate our goals and everything in moral terms, and it could be that we need different rhetorics for different people. But, you know, when we're engaging in war, I don't see it as constrained much by moral principles.
No, that's the declaration of war is precisely there so that you can protect the moral regime.
Yeah, exactly. And that could sell. I mean, it could sell to people eventually.
Right.
Because I think people are going to see that as they see their societies destroyed more and more. I mean, and I think our society is way better off than, say, the UK. The UK is in crisis.
Right.
You know, they have admitted so many of these Muslims and so many Africans. You've just got a completely broken down society right now. And I think that people, the UK, average UK person has to be wondering where this is going. You know, white people are going to find that they just have to move away from it. But how far can you move away from it in England? You know, it's just, I think that something has got to give there. And we're just going to see the end of it. We're going to put a review on Occidental Observer of Douglas Murray's book on immigration. Now, he's not entirely on board with any of our stuff, but he's certainly an excellent critic of immigration. And, you know, he he's very pessimistic about the future. He does not think this can be turned around, and that entire British civilization that they evolved for 1,000 years is going down the drain, and they can't reverse it. And of course, partly, you know, you still have huge numbers of Brits who you know, welcome refugees and condemn any criticism of this whole thing. I'm very pessimistic myself, I guess, about the UK. I'm an optimistic personality in general, but you see what's happening there.
Yeah.
It's just impossible to turn around. Now, in America, you got, you know, most of the immigrants are from Mexico or something. They're not as incompatible as these Muslims and Africans. Now, we've got plenty of those, and we got plenty of Muslims and plenty of Africans, but percentage-wise, it's nowhere near where it is in England. And
well, it seems to me that there's a strategic failure in the ostensible white leadership,
in the
sense that the failure to understand how critical a declaration of war is to whites, vital it is to white interests that there be a declaration of war. The failure to understand that has led to a lot of discourse that simply creates depression in people.
Right.
And, you know, because like, okay, yeah, I get it. I've heard this, you know, enough. And, you know, for guys like you and I who have been conscious of this for decades, you know, we sort of developed some immunity, and also because of the fact that we had the sense of obligation that we had to stand up as individuals. You know, but other people, you know, there comes a point where they simply have to give in. And then once they do that, their integrity's broken. They're psychologically broken. They're emotionally broken. They start dying like working class whites do.
Yeah.
And this is all because the leadership has not focused on framing a declaration of war in moral
terms. How would you frame this declaration of war in terms of who are we fighting against exactly? I mean,
against
all immigrants, we're fighting against.
Right.
These elites, we're fighting against the media, we're fighting against Jews. What are we fighting against?
That is the question. I mean, if it's more important to identify them than it is to identify us. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. And
if you don't identify them in a way that's relatively objective and operational, because you know, when you're engaging in war, you're engaging in operations. If you don't do it in those terms, then you're leaving people in a situation where they're sort of in a half state of war. And in a half state of war, you don't have the discipline. You have people sacrificing themselves that are heroic in nature, and you're losing the best of your people. You know, very, very bad to be in this gray zone. It's like, you know, it's very bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to frame the enemy right now in terms that would seem as like moral to most white people.
Well, let me give you
Somali immigrants should be deported or something.
Yeah, let me give you an example. Sometimes I'll be talking to hardcore neo-Nazi types, and I'll talk to them about Jews. I've actually, you know, gotten some agreement about the following proposition. If a Jew would agree that it's okay to exclude them from your territory and your government and your society, would you be willing to consider them not an enemy? And surprisingly, I have gotten, you know, the answer. I mean, to really hardcore guys, like in leadership positions, that say, yeah, I could consider them to not be an enemy. Okay, now that's a while ago, but you know, as time has gone on, people are getting more and more angry and reactive and unable to reflect very well. You know, that's the potential for that kind of tolerance is starting to decrease, I've noticed. Okay, but that kind of litmus test is one way of approaching sort of an operational definition. Now, since then, I've come up with another, you know, more general operational definition, which if there is somebody, and let's talk about an individual, there's an individual who is not acting in such a way as to render it impractical for me to exclude them from my society, then they're not enemy.
So you mean if say a Somali person is not acting in a way that would compromise? It seems to me that just having these people in the society ultimately is going, you can't keep democratic institutions or anything.
Right. Well, that gets onto a question of the judgment about what I said. In other words, if there's some Somali in Minnesota, and they're nice people, and they, you know, have a little shop or something like that, I don't know, right? I look at them and I say, are they acting in such a way as to make it impractical for me to exclude them from my society? And go, well, they're here, right?
Right. They're not going to vote. You know, ultimately, they're not going to vote on your side. And, you know, they're the other thing that, you know, that really, you know, was an aspect of Douglas Murray's book, and in which I've noticed for a long time, is that individualistic people tend to have fewer children and everything else when they perceive things as more crowded, economic conditions aren't quite as good or something like that. And that's not the case with these other groups. And so just the presence of those people,
right,
and the conflict and so on, that produces, I think, a sense that you know, of not having children, not investing in the future.
Right.
That, you know, is poisonous.
That's right. And there are many whites, of course, who wouldn't perceive things that way. In other words, there are a lot of Minnesota whites who say, well, my judgment is that this Somali is not acting in such a way as to make it impossible for me to exclude them. Right. But others of us who have different perceptions and different sort of Weltanschauungs or whatever, different models of the world, perceive that as something that they are doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Now it gets to the point where you've got some whites that are now in opposition to each other over their perceptions of this particular kind of test, right?
Yeah.
Now, so then the question becomes, how can I exclude, do those whites act in such a way as to make it so that I can't exclude them from my society, as well as their supposedly acceptable Somalis, right?
Yeah, I would have no problem excluding certain whites for sure. I mean, these people are just—they're beyond hope, and I think that.
Is it not the case? I mean, I don't know if there's been any studies about this, but it seems like just anecdotally, from my perception, that people who are actually in contact with the consequences of their social theories tend to learn. Or at least, you know, they tend to bifurcate. They either go all the way into complete sort of, you know, religious zombieism, or they wake up.
Yeah.
And that happens in a lot of places like L.A. and New York City. Okay.
All right, but I worry that if you just allowed them into your white ethnostate, there would be a divisive, critical element. And if you forced them to live in the L.A.s and the in this diverse, you say you divide America up into a white area and a non-white area, and some white people would hate to live in a white ethnostate, so they'd live with the non-whites. I think eventually these people would want to emigrate back to the white place.
Well, being from Iowa and actually coming back to Iowa after 50 years or so, something that, and I also noticed this when I moved up to the Pacific Northwest from California, the people who were from there had the only contact they had with other cultures was through the, you know, mass media. And of course their perception was that it was important to get more diversity coming into their area because of the fact that, you know, well, we're a bunch of hicks out here in Iowa or Pacific Northwest, and so we really
need some vibrancy out here.
Yeah, we need more of this because obviously, you know, we're not being moral, and part of the reason we're not being moral is because of the fact that we're acting as a group of whites against these poor, you know, like minorities, right? And so you've got these people who in previous generations might have been, you know, church ladies or whatever, but they're acting in such a way as to try to, you know, comply with the moral mandates of the present era.
That's right.
Those people are in the whitest areas of the United States.
Absolutely.
And they are completely out of touch with reality, and they engage in a lot of altruistic punishment of other whites.
Right.
Okay.
And they bring, and they're, a lot of them are really, encouraged immigration of non-whites into their area.
Well, yeah, I mean, there a lot of them are literal church ladies, and they have these NGOs that are getting money from the government to settle people in the communities against the will of the communities, and then they'd have no responsibility for any damage under the community. All they get is social status in the eyes of this cosmopolitan thing.
That anybody who disagrees with them.
Right. So it's very important that those people be forcibly ejected into places like Los Angeles.
I agree. They have to go there, and then we'd allow them to come back after they repent for their sins.
Precisely. I mean, I guess. So what I'm trying to say is the declaration of war. Okay, yeah. Is sort of in terms that I've called certocracy. You sort proponents of social theories into governments that test them. And what this does is it says, okay, you like individualism, scientific method, the Enlightenment philosophies. We're going there right now. You believe that it's important to have diversity of cultures. You believe that it's okay to have Somalis in your neighborhoods. And that's what you're going to get. But you're not going to impose it on anybody else. And if you try to, you're dead. We kill you.
I like that. Yeah,
we will give you free transportation, relocation expenses, all the rest of it to the place that is embodying your beliefs, and you can walk your talk all you want, but you can't come in if we don't let you, right?
Yeah.
So then the big question becomes, how do you allocate territory? And the big practical question becomes, because transportation's easy. You can, transport people. But being able to get territorial allocation done is where the real nub comes when you get this population.
I think we have to think in terms of deportation. And that again, that requires a political consensus that is just way far off at this point.
If we could sort of all of a sudden magically take over the mass media or have the alternative media revolution and take out academia as we know it and media as we know it, right? And then, wait a generation to try, hopefully get, young people at least thinking more diversity and have more diversity of thought, right? Than this, monolithic mass media academia thing. But boy, do we have the time? Do we have the time to wait for that kind of?
Oh yeah, right.
I mean, there's tremendous risks here. For example, I got involved with the internet like in the early '80s with a newspaper chain, Knight Ritter, and came into direct conflict where they did not want to have anything like blogs because they wanted to have editorial control, right? And I said, that's not where things are going. The market tests show this. It's not the American tradition. We should be opening these things up, as wide as possible. I had to resign from that. But we're seeing now with YouTube and Twitter and some of those other things where you've got this recentralization of control where they're starting to engage in censorship again.
Oh, yeah.
There's a big risk here that there will be another, even though the old media may pass away, the new media is being re-centralized and having this demonetization, being able to delete accounts, and it's real hard to escape from the network effects because that's where everybody is. You have to go where everybody is. That's what makes these things natural monopolies. So there are technical fixes to that too, but I try to tell people about how to approach this strategically, but nobody wants to talk about it,
I think there's a strong commitment to free speech in the sort of internet, sort of tech nerdy community, community. They've always been that way, but there are big forces that want censorship, and certainly Jewish organizations have been pushing that for a long time. I worry about, hate speech laws. You already see in England and Germany, UK and in Germany, where people can get thrown in prison for Twitter tweets or Facebook postings,
right?
And that's what they want. So they are clamping down on the new media for sure. This has always been a top down phenomenon, and media has played a huge crucial role. And it's interesting that the other day I noticed there's a study that came out basically showing that people that when Trump won, that people were much more willing to assert sort of xenophobic ideas, And I think that's the thing. If we had the media, we could turn this around in a heartbeat, you know, because people are willing. It's like when they don't have any sense of legitimacy coming at them, when they will turn on a TV, read a newspaper, anything like that. That's one thing. But if they do feel that those ideas are okay, boy, they come out pretty fast. And Trump, you know, really did unleash a lot of that. Now what they've done, of course, is just paralyze his administration with these ridiculous Russian collusion charges, as if this is really an important issue. They're going to fight back with everything they can. But they, I think they're really worried that this was a major breach in their ideal world.
Yeah, obviously it was, and obviously also the internet's decentralization of discourse played a major role in that.
Yeah.
And it's going to continue to play a major role in that. I mean, I think a lot of what's going on with the mass media, the old legacy media, as some people call it, is that to some degree there's a recognition that this means of social control is diminishing in its power.
Yeah.
As you know, subscribers are going away from New York Times, et cetera. And part of the reason that they've been so willing to sacrifice their capability is sort of like you have a company that you've purchased that has a good name that's been built up over a century, but you can see it's doomed, then you'll simply engage in fraud. And sell out the name of the company because it's on its last legs. So I think what's going on with a lot of these mass media companies is they're starting to realize that the legacy media is terminal. And so they've got to basically just go ahead and liquidate the good name of, you know, the credibility while they can. And that's what they've been doing.
I would hope that'd be true. That was one of the messages of the Trump campaign, that you had wall-to-wall media condemnation of Trump and just no uncertain terms, and that's continued after the election. But he won the election, and he still has very substantial support.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all clear that he won't win re-election in 4 years. I think that could easily happen.
Right.
That is a blow to the media, because the media has just been unsparing. And
right.
If you read some of these leftist, sort of liberal blogs and Twitter posts and so on, they're just absolutely banging their head against the wall here. The hatred is just palpable.
Right. And, you know, what they realize is that, you know, they don't have the truth on their side.
Yeah.
The way I sort of see it, my sort of, you know, metaphor is that you've got this, you know, gang that has this woman in the base that they've been raping, right? and she has sort of over time said, well, I love you guys, right? But every now and then she'll come out with some kind of behavior like she's trying to get away. Right. And they go, you know, if you get away, you don't, you know, you say you love us, but if you get away, you're going to call the man on us. Right. You know, it's like, oh, no, I won't. Right. And I think that it's like that. You know, they have this gang has a guilty conscience about what they've been doing. And they know that if there's any, they basically have to kill us.
Because that's the thing. They have to kill us because they have gone way too far. What they have done is unforgivable.
Right.
And it's something that you can't just say, well, yeah, I know you guys, you can't frame it as, well, you guys made a mistake, because it was not a mistake. This was a conscious policy. And what they have done is just completely destroy, attempt to destroy our people and our culture. And so that's unforgivable. And the only thing you can do then is some kind of extreme response in the end. And so they have to keep upping their ante every time, because they built this sort of house of cards ultimately that could, you know, that is always in danger of completely collapsing, because it's always built on these lies.
Right.
And it's unstable.
Yeah, I would not put it so much
in
I wouldn't, you know, judge people so much on their conscious intent as I would on what their actions produce.
Yeah, well, I go back to that. I agree. There's some that are conscious, and I think Jewish ethnic activists have been consciously pursuing this. But I do think a lot of their people that are cooperating with them, these messages, the white.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out a word for the old definition of conspire that actually might resurrect the useful definition. One of the words I've thought of is co-inspire, or just co-spire, right? In other words, rather than conspire, if you maybe co-spire is better. So you have co-spirators, because they share the same spirit, okay? Yeah. And they might not even consciously recognize that what they're doing is they're reacting to a deep terror they have of justice.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's in fact what's going on, at a subconscious level or co-spiritual way. But so they're trying to do whatever they can to prevent there from being a recognition that there has been warfare conducted against whites.
That's
over an extended
right.
period
that
of time.
Is absolutely right. And that
because
is
if there is that perception, then there could be a declaration of war by the whites, and then it's all over.
Yeah, because we still have the power to turn it around. We right. could turn it around.
No, and it's simply a matter of morale.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and the morale.
Political.
That's what I'm trying to say is that the moral declaration of war, or the declaration of moral war, okay, in operational terms, that people can get behind is so key that to not focus on that at this stage, I think is very destructive.
Very destructive. Yeah.
And it's very destructive because people end up in all this discourse about other things, about ancillary things, about basically saying, you know, well, we're you know, here's some more evidence that we're under attack. And for the vast majority of people, no amount of evidence is going to do anything for them until there's a declaration, because they know that they're individuals facing, you know, implacable and personal forces that will destroy them if they do anything out of line.
Yeah.
Okay. So if they don't see an actual moral declaration of war that they can think about the words, and they can see other people thinking about the words and getting behind it, so that there's actually a movement behind that declaration that allows them to say, okay, I might be safe now. Okay, I think that vast majority of people are just going to not even think about anything and just go ahead and try to adapt, and all the evidence that you come up with about all the rapes and all the murders and all the terrorists, or all the, you know, financial parasitism from high places, and all the subterfuge about, you know, immigration. 90% of the population opposes increases in immigration for decades, and 10% of the population holds sway over that vital interest. I mean, all that stuff, you can present all the evidence you want, and the vast majority of people, it just won't matter to them.
Yeah.
Because they got, you know, they're in survival mode, and they are under, you know, they're under attack.
Yeah.
They're isolated and under attack. So they need to have this focal point, the declaration. Mm-hmm. And once you have that, then you have something that I guess Drew Frazier, you know, in his book, The Wasp Question, sort of talked about this difficulty that wasps have in operating outside of sort of a contractual milieu.
Yeah. That's right.
And that's the declaration of war, is in a sense the contract that we will submerge our individual interests for this group organism to act in a cohesive and disciplined manner, so that we can get back to living our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's really where we're at right now, is we can't live our lives. We're also under attack. And so part of the thing is, well, what is it about the leadership of white identity that is distracting them from this task?
Well, I think implicitly there is a sense of warfare, but yeah, I think an explicit declaration of war, a manifesto. I think there are people. I just talked to Greg Johnson. He wants to put out a manifesto, and now that we're talking about this, maybe I would do something like that. But yeah, we have to declare war. We should be in a war footing. We should have been in a war footing a long time ago. The thing is that, you know, this whole thing snuck up on us. It creeped up. It started out with the 1965 immigration law that simply didn't discriminate against different parts of the world. But at that time, the actual numbers of immigrants were very, very low. But what that happened then the activists keep ramping up the numbers. And now we have a situation that threatens the very fabric of our society. So it's insidious.
Well, if you look at around at the global economy, for example, where you've got this sort of global capitalism that is having destructive effects all over the place, in part, it is because of the fact that it has this sort of Enlightenment-era pseudo-individualism behind it. In other words, it atomizes people who are really ill-adapted to a Western style of individualism.
Yeah, and there's an attempt to do that, I think.
Right.
Their ideal world is that we all are atomized individuals and we go shopping a lot, you know.
Right, right. And so that's what I call a pseudo-individual, because once you're doing that, you really are a component of this sort of group organism that's global and sort of operating for an objective function that might be thought of as profit, I guess. But in any case, it's the kind of thing where humans can be replaced. Okay, it's like ultimately you could just have machines like owning everything and consuming and producing stuff like that, and humans are sort of like in the way of that whole thing. But in terms of the West, we have a deeper sense of individualism than this consumerism. Okay, I think that our sense of individualism comes from, as we've talked about before, our evolutionary heritage, and it actually gets into a kind of thing that we see individual integrity as being a moral good that other societies or other cultures might not see. But nevertheless, what has happened by this sort of Enlightenment pseudo-individualism spreading worldwide, it has done two things. On the one hand, it has allowed all these other cultures to come into ours saying, yeah, we're just individuals like you engaged in this like Enlightenment pseudo-individualism where we're all going to make money and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
And of course, they continue to behave in these group cohesive manners, and so you get things like like Jews coming in and occupying positions of trust and authority and acting in a cohesive manner, and whether they're doing consciously or not, the effects are very obviously destructive.
Yeah.
I should say something about this because that really kind of is important. I went through about 15 years ago looking for ecological causes of autism. And one of the things I did was I just gathered ecological data on demographic variables, crime, and all kinds of other things at the state level. So you had state-level ecologies, and I was looking for correlations, ecological correlations at the state level, and testing out various theories and that there were out there, like refrigerator mother and vaccination and stuff like that. And at one point, I decided, because I had some interest in the Jewish question, I decided to sort of ask, well, what is the correlation with Jewish percentage of whites on a state-by-state basis, right? And it turned out the highest correlation was AIDS and HIV positive. Which, given the immune suppression function of a lot of Jewish intellectual movements, is really interesting. Okay, but
yeah, it's part of an artifact. It's part of an artifact of Jews congregating in big cities, and you got all these gay people there, and all that.
Yeah, but it was just kind of interesting. That was like that came out on top. But so I decided, well, that's interesting. I'm going to look at the correlations, see which of the demographic variables are most predictive of the others. In other words, if you just look at the coefficient of determination, R squared, and then say, okay, well, which demographic variable has the average R squared that's highest, right? And Jewish percent of whites came out on top.
Really? Were you saying that for autism?
No. I said I had collected hundreds of demographic variables to try to, ferret out what might have been contributing to autism.
Yeah.
And I just sort of at one point, and a couple of years later, I turned it around and wanted to look at some other correlations. You know, and so I shifted into doing data mining, basically, because previously I'd just been testing hypotheses that I had previously. But anyway, so I went into the data mining thing. But, I wanted to just think about the Jewish percent of whites because I saw that as being, like, particularly critical. You take any variable, and then you say, what is its correlation with all the other variables averaged, right? And that sort of tells you how much you can explain about society in terms of one variable. Well, it turned out that Jewish percent of whites was the most powerful variable that you could choose to explain things about society if you want to look at one variable.
So you had a wide range of dependents.
Yeah, about 300 variables.
Wow.
And, I changed that, like, maybe around 200 variables. And then later I had a whole bunch of crime variables, like, you know, broken down by year, et cetera, right? And when I did it that way, then I had Russian percentage of whites. Okay, which, given the Russian immigration percentages that are Jewish, particularly given the fact that you had people coming from Russia, I mean, if you read 200 years together, by Solzhenitsyn's, that's another interesting thing. But the reason I bring all this up is clearly I understand quite well. I mean, I read Cultural Critique and I, did this. You don't have to sell me on the importance of Jewish influence on society. I didn't even intend to come up with this. And this is like, whoa, just like came out and smashed me in the face. And of course, all the arguments against that are, oh, well, ecological correlations are invalid and correlation doesn't imply causation, blah, blah, blah. But, there's some point at which you have to start saying, we got to start somewhere with our statistics and understand what's going on. And that was one of the things that motivated me to start looking at this idea of the laboratory of the states, sort of as a constitutional argument for separating people based on their social theories. Right? Because they say, well, correlation doesn't imply causation. Well, how do you go about ferreting out causation from correlation? And, what you do is you do have experimental controls. So you don't have all the variables being conflated all the time. And one of the ways you can do that is by, social basis is like separate people according to their social theory so you can actually test them out and get some data. Right? And so who can argue against that? Well, If you want to try to actually be consistent with all these Enlightenment values and science and all the rest of this stuff, then you can't really argue against it. Yeah. Because you're arguing against truth. And you can't really argue against it from the basis of freedom because, you can walk your talk. And what is freedom other than being able to walk your talk, right?
Unfortunately, the reality is, of course, that the truth about, say, race differences and all this are routinely criticized or just rejected in the academic world and in the media.
Well, right. And the reason they do that is because there's a central government that they are using to impose these theories on us for other purposes, right? But if you simply say, okay, fine, you want to believe that there is no contribution to societally important phenomena by, heritable racial characteristics, you're entitled to that belief. You're entitled to live with the consequences of that belief. You're not entitled to impose it on us. Okay, you're over there doing that. We have a barrier. You can't come in. You can exclude us if you want, right? And we'll just see what happens. Okay? And that's fair. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that should appeal to whites that aren't simply engaged in what can only be thought of as a lack of integrity and defection against their own moral principles. I mean, all these people who are running around, you can't be racist because that's the groups ganging up against individuals or, minorities or whatever, right? It's like, no, you can have whatever beliefs you want to about that stuff and, you can live with it and we can live with ours. And we'll just see what happens on a scientific basis and therefore we have consent. And we have, freedom. The reason I'm focusing on this is that a manifesto is longer than a declaration of war.
Yeah.
In other words, it's like in legislation, you'll have, sort of a bunch of whereas clauses, right? And then you'll have definitions and you'll have the actual legislation itself. And there may need to be some definition of terms and stuff like that, but, you know, the declaration needs to be very short and sweet and use conventional terminology that like Joe Blow, who's going to be getting out there and sacrificing his life, understands. You know, and you can see that the declaration has an endpoint, that if you achieve it, like, there's light at the end of the tunnel, we can get back to living when we achieve this.
I should, you know, think about writing a declaration of war. I mean, it is important to be explicit to do this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something that really short and sweet, like, you know, not much longer than the preamble of the Constitution. Yeah. And then all the other verbiage is, like, you know, in support of understanding what that is, yeah. Right? And that would be like the manifesto, I suppose. But the declaration itself has to be something that, like, you know, working class white can say, I got it, and I can see all these, you know, all these white liberals are out there just being hypocrites, and I want to get them out of my society and let them, you know, learn the lesson, right? But do it in such a way that there's some kind of fair and equitable, you know, allocation of territory, so that people can actually live out their lives according to their beliefs. And if they aren't willing to do that, then we have to take forceful action.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Dr. Kevin MacDonald.